This is the network break from the Packet Pushers. Now, Drew is on leave this week, so there's a dire shortage of virtual donuts around here. But I have asked Jonah Till-Johnson, the boss person from Nemerdy's Research, to be my co-host for today's show. Welcome to the network break, Jonah. So hi to the network breakers.
Greetings all, and thank you very much, Greg. Happy to be here.
No worry. So let's get straight into it. Let's very quickly take some time to thank our sponsors for today. First sponsor today is AppNetta. Now, Packet Pushers and AppNetta are having a live virtual event on Tuesday. By the time you get this, it's just a couple of days away, and we'll be having it in an unwebinar format. We'll be tackling your top five performance pain points. So instead of having one 60-minute drone session, this will be five short, sharp sessions so that you don't have to be bored witless by some people talking at you for 60 minutes. I'm going to be there. And the CEO of AppNetta seems to be a really cool person. And he said, I want you to be full Greg. So get ready for that. If you want to attend, get over to appnetta.com/pplive. That's appnetta.com/pplive. And also sponsored today by PingPlotter. PingPlotter's Cloud Connect is a remote network monitoring tool, as it should be, without the typical multi-year contracts or SaaS bloat. Test internal and endpoint connectivity, track performance metrics with a solution that deploys in minute. Schedule a free 15-minute overview at pingplotter.com/packetpushers to see how Cloud Connect makes remote IT suck less. And stay tuned for a Tech Bytes at the end of today's show from Fortinet. We did an interview with an engineer who's been running 300 sites on a Fortinet SD-WAN, and he tells the story of how he moved from one SD-WAN vendor to a secure branch solution. It's a really good story, so hopefully you can tune in. Let's get straight into the news. Let's start off with some follow-up. We got some Jason emailed me last week after I talked about the smart NICs that Cisco released, and he said they're part of the recent Exablaze acquisition. Which is a good pickup because I forgot that Cisco actually acquired Exablaze, which is a unique vendor. But when I talked about them last week, I said these NICs seem to have a specific purpose, and so they do. And I didn't see the connection between Exablaze. Exablaze is a company that uses FPGA for super low latency forwarding, and I'm talking about not switching. They're actually forwarding almost at an electrical level. Cisco did actually follow up the smart NIC announcement last week with a switch announcement this week. These are sort of a type of switch which are used in high speed financial trading, mostly used for high speed, super low latency, much lower than normal switches. And if you're into that sort of thing, you'll know all about it. And if you're not into that sort of thing, you won't know all about it. Let's transition into one of my favorite pieces of news this week. Jonah, I think you'll like this one. A Dutch telco got permission to scrap some of its TDM network this week. The Dutch government actually gave the KPN, which is the Dutch national telco, the ability to shut down a bunch of its T1 E1s and a whole bunch of legacy updates. What do you think? Did you find that amusing?
Well, Greg, you know, we'll know they're serious when they shut down ISDN. So for those of you with long memories, ISDN, also known as I Still Don't Need, was the telco's approach to integrating voice and data over circuit switching that they were developing at the very, they had terrible timing developing it because they were developing it at the same time as this new WYSI protocol called TCP/IP. So I'm hoping somebody's going to tell, you know, KPN about that sometime soon.
Yeah, well, I think the realization I had when I was reading this was it's, we like to think of telcos or mobile cos as modern companies, you know, rapidly moving and iterating around data-based networks and all that. And then all of a sudden you get a slap in the face and you realize that they're actually monopolies with a government-issued mandate to make money from a restricted license. And the old legacy networks are actually that, right?
Well, I have to say, the fact that you say we like to think of telcos as modern WYSI companies, marketing departments around the globe are now cheering because it took them about 25 years to get that message across. Yes. But, you know, you talk about regulation, and I've got to point something out about regulation and telcos. I do a lot of work around innovation and how you can enable innovation. Mm. And one of the things that's interesting in the U.S., one of the most innovative organizations at the time was not Google, but actually AT&T when it was running Bell Labs. And it turns out that the reason it was so incredibly innovative was the government forced them to not make more than a certain amount in profit. So after they'd given all the executives bonuses and fancy furniture in the offices and wined and dined them, and they blew all the money they could possibly blow, they had a little bit left over and they still had to spend it. So they set up this lab and funded a bunch of geeks. And, you know, I look at that and I go, that's actually brilliant. And I wish we could do more of that. And I wouldn't be unhappy if we forced innovation in that way across a broader range of companies.
Yeah, there's always been a balance here to strike about public services and how the government engages. I know that it's currently the fashion or currently the trend to say companies should be companies and capitalism should be capitalism. But I've always been a follower of there should be bounds or restrictions around capitalism to prevent the worst of it. And the mobile telephone companies are probably the ones who are demonstrating that they really need to have a social responsibility to make the world better instead of just making profits for their shareholders.
Well, Greg, I just have to tell you, that means you're a socialist and an evil socialist and should be damned, apparently. But yeah, I have to say I agree with you.
I resent the socialist tag. I'm more of a centrist. I believe that if you actually go back far enough in the history here, capitalism was actually founded to bring people out of poverty. The idea behind capitalism in the Keynesian era, when John Keynes came up with the fundamental ideas of market competition, the idea was that capitalism would improve the lot of poor people. That was its purpose.
Oh, and I couldn't agree with it more. I was actually being sarcastic because anyone that says there are any bounds on anything and other than raw, unfettered capitalism is clearly a socialist and, you know, should be sent to the gulag.
I don't want to go back to the old days of when telcos were government-owned completely. That was not right. But we should have some rules around and some restrictions, I think.
No, and I think we've also... Absolutely. And I was being horribly sarcastic. I agree 100% with your perspective. But I would also say things like universal service from this perspective of telcos generally desperately needs a redefinition and a rethink. But that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, they should be able to provide a basic level of service for a fixed fee to cover everybody. It shouldn't just be straight out exploitation.
Correct.
A wild west. Moving on to our next topic for today, Arista has shipped a whole raft of new campus hardware. So Arista continues with its proprietary branding of Cognitive Campus. Arista, of course, is always the butt of jokes by me because it's always got to come up with a name for things. And they can't just call it their campus networking strategy. They have to give it a fancy trademark name. So it's Cognitive Campus. Hope you like it. More hardware to fit the campus price points, because up until now, Arista's had this really expensive. It's taken its data center gear and said, that's campus. And, of course, the pricing is all wrong. The chips inside it, the product, power supplies, and all the line cards are using data center class switches, features and pricing, and that's all wrong. I guess if I wanted to summarize this announcement, Arista is announced the 750 series, which is a couple of different things. It's three switches in the 1RU, 2RU form factor. They're all PoE, 1 gig, multi-gig, and they're all 24, 48, 96 ports, which you pretty much would expect. You can check out Cisco Arista's website for them. But weirdly, they came out with a chassis, the 750 series, which looks like the 7500, but it must have different guts where the chips and everything are cut down. I thought from the product announcement that I was looking at, there was three things that they were emphasizing in the announcement. MACsec encryption, so they've got the centralized controller, their CloudVision, campus CloudVision, which operates the campus. And so they're doing MACsec to every host. Lots of features around PoE, which they got very excited about, which I got a bit tediously bored about. But then the chassis-based switches. What did you think, Jonah?
Well, given that according to our research, 61% of the traffic initiates or terminates or both off-premise, this is a little like getting new wheels on your buggy. That said, if you're Amish, you can rejoice because actually they are going after the right set of features for enterprise users. I love the end-to-end encryption and the whole, power efficiency is actually a big deal because as companies, to the extent that we return to offices and campuses, we're going to be paying a lot more attention to smart energy, and that's exactly what's needed. So even though we believe that there are going to be fewer smarter buildings, having PoE and the power efficiency built in is actually going to be a very, very big deal, and I'm glad they're emphasizing that because not too many companies are paying attention to that.
Yeah. Now, you obviously research. You actually do hard research on these topics instead of just me where I just make things up, right? So from what I can see, most research – in companies or research analysts are saying there's a definite demand in the campus to overhaul a lot of the technology that's in place. A lot of the campus gear is obsolete, like 10 plus years old and so forth and so on. Do you think it's going to be a significant market going forward, or is it just there's just like the growth of this market is stymied as we go through the COVID pandemic era?
Well, I'm not a market researcher, so I can't really speak authoritatively to the market, but my guess is there will be continued growth, but it's flattening off. It's kind of plateauing. And the reason for that, again, is the campus itself is becoming less and less important in the scheme of things. That said, I agree with your main point, which is an end-to-end network overhaul is underway now among most of the leading enterprises.
Yeah, I have a general belief that the campus network should just be a low-cost way to access an internet connection, and that all of the security should be in the endpoint. So your computer should have a VPN client, your laptop should have a VPN client, and it shouldn't matter whether you're connected to a campus network or you're sitting at your local coffee shop or co-working facility. There should be no security in the campus at all, in my view.
I agree with you. I mean, this is really where zero trust security really plays. And of course, it has such a catchy, snazzy name that it's dead wrong, because it's not about zero trust at all. It's about a highly granular, dynamic network of trust, so that you can essentially decide what processes are trusted based on where the user is, where the endpoint is, what network it's connected to, blah, blah, blah. So it's really about a very dynamic authentication and authorization at a very granular level. But yes, the campus network then just becomes the bit pipe.
Yeah, that's my belief, is that over time, it makes no sense to have it. But there again, if you are a hospital and you've got things plugged into the campus network, you might actually be in a different situation. Or if you're still in a world that uses printers, the world is pretty miserable for you. So there is still some demand there for the campus, but I don't believe it's a growth market. And I do wonder if all these companies who came back to the enterprise with campus strategies are sort of looking at COVID going, oh, shucks, that didn't work out.
No, I think they're saying something a lot stronger, but yeah.
Google Chrome is continuing to upset everybody. It's announced the team behind the Google Chrome development have announced that it will have a separate root store for certificates. So this means that the Chrome team is going to include a certificate store inside of Chrome, which would be separate from the certificate store in your computer operating system, and thus require, for most enterprises, a pretty substantial amount of effort where if you're installing certificates directly into the thing. So the days of installing stuff into the Microsoft Windows certificate store and then Chrome just uses that, that's going to go away. Although, on the other hand, given the security of Microsoft Windows over the last 30 years, that's probably going to be a good thing.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, because Microsoft is historically bad at two things, and they continue to be bad at those two things. One is networking, and the other one is security.
On the bright side, Firefox has its own certificate store. So if you're used to using Firefox and fitting it up, your Chrome's not going to be any different. But if you're not, you're going to face an uphill battle. I think this is also another step closer to Google Chrome as an operating system. So the idea is that 5 or 10 years ago, Google was trying to support Chrome OS. And I think Google realized that, why bother? Why not just put everything into Google Chrome, Bluetooth, MIDI, everything. And putting the certificate store in there is the next step down that path. Sticking with Google, I was reading an article from Business Insider this week. Somebody was reporting on their personal Google account that had been locked out. And 15 years of email, 15 years of documents, all that sort of stuff is suddenly locked behind. And anytime he tried to find a way to appeal or to get through them, Google just stymied him completely. And I think the angle here is, what about happens if this is for corporate Google as well? And I'm a bit concerned that corporate Google would do the same thing, because I know from my G Suite, G Docs, Work Suite, whatever it's called this week, they keep coming up with a different name every 3 weeks, it seems. If I lost access to that, my business would be dead in the water.
Well, let me ask you this. Then why are you using Google if that's what you think? Just out of curiosity.
Mainly because it was the easiest way to solve a problem 10 years ago, and now there's still no viable alternative. I find it very difficult to share documents effectively over the internet, even in 2020. And goodness knows I keep looking for an alternative.
And I hear you. They have done a brilliant job with the integration. And of course, when they roll everything out with free being the first iteration and cheap being the second, it's really hard to say no. But that said, I was waiting until this point to just weigh in on Google. But I think anyone that's doing business with Google has to remember something very key, which is Google is in the business of selling eyeballs to advertisers. Full stop. You are not a Google customer. Even if you give them money, you're a Google product. Now, it's true that in the enterprise, they have a small carved out space that says, okay, we're going to try to see what we can do here in the enterprise. But one of the things I found fascinating about this story was he couldn't contact support. I had a massive flashback to Google rolling out its first phone and standing up there proudly saying, we don't have a contact center because people aren't going to need to call in. And I just remember just falling over laughing, saying, these guys do not get end users. And they still don't. 10 years in, I just was talking to a large enterprise yesterday, and I reminded them that, you know, you are not a customer to them. You're just a bunch of eyeballs, even though you're paying them money and you expect them to give you service.
Yes, you're a customer of Google like a bee is to a beekeeper. The bee wants the honey, doesn't want the bees.
Yeah, and just be happy. It's not more like you know, a pig is to a farmer.
That's true. Google doesn't really care whether you as a customer like them or not. And all, as you say, everything's about the ad business, and everything else is just an accessory. I think they really missed a chance there because Office 365 should have died. But it literally comes down to this problem. You can't trust Google to give you access to your data, whereas Microsoft at least has a telephone line and some enterprise salespeople for the moments that matter.
Well, and above and beyond that, as much as I like to beat on Microsoft, they do one thing extremely well, which is their enterprise licensing. So what tends to happen is a competitor comes out with a new interesting product. People start moving to that. Microsoft follows up and makes an also ran competitor and then prices it at a point where you can't afford not to go with it if you're a large enterprise.
And they're good at that. Jacks up the price when nobody's looking.
Yes, that too.
Microsoft is very good at that. Let's take a moment now to thank our sponsor today, AppNetter. Now, on Tuesday, November the 10th, that's just tomorrow after the day the show's released, we're hosting a live virtual event with AppNetter on tackling your five biggest pain points for the network and its application performance. We've been working hard with the AppNetter team to design an unwebinar. That is, it's not a boring, tedious webinar where people just talk at you and pretend that you know nothing. It's going to be fast-paced, informative, and in some form engaging. So go over to appnetter.com/pplive to register for that. The 90-minute event will be broken down into mini segments on five major topics, including DIA connectivity, getting remote worker visibility, and managing the performance of collaboration and apps. Now, you know AppNetter, they've been on the network several times talking about their network visibility and monitoring tools and how they're uniquely addressing it. And we're trying to keep and be moderating each segment to keep the event moving. And we'll also be taking your live questions if that's your thing. So go over to appnetter.com/pplive. Mark your calendar for Tuesday, November the 10th at 11 a.m. Eastern US. And we hope to see you there. That's appnetter.com/pplive. All right, back to the news. One of the things that we've been tracking here on the Network Break is Vodafone keeps committing to Open RAN. Open RAN is the technology where your 5G base station will actually be built around a number of open components, not necessarily open source. Some of them will. But in this particular article here from the IEEE Computer Society, they're highlighting that Vodafone is now actually threatening to perform trials of Open RAN to replace its entire Huawei infrastructure. Huawei owns about a third of the Vodafone infrastructure here in the UK. And obviously, with recent changes, the Huawei stuff will be rotated out in the next refresh cycle. And if Vodafone replaces one third of its mobile phone network, as by far and away the leading mobile co in the UK, that actually gives Open RAN a lot of legs. What do you think?
I think actually this is a good development. And when you say it's O-RAN is getting a lot of legs, it's the right thing. Because essentially what's happening is they're moving towards hardware as a commodity and all the horsepower being in software and open software at that. We've seen that model succeed again and again and again. So seeing that coming to 5G is actually a really positive sign. And I read this and thought, wow, this is great. I see AT&T is going in the same general direction in the US. So I expect to see a lot more legs on O-RAN in 2020 and more importantly in 2021. So this is going to be a really interesting space to watch.
Yeah, because I think it gives the telcos an infrastructure. Up until now, they've always bought their mobile technology as a sealed box. And the way that they got competition was they said to things like, well, you can have this part of the country, Ericsson, and you can have this part of the country, Nokia, and you can have this part of the country, you know, Samsung. And then they put in a billing system that collects the records from all of them, and then they sort of let them all fight it out to see who can have a greater percentage. You know, you get 20, but you get 40 if your price is better or something like that.
Yeah. And Well, and what I think is actually really interesting is the timing is right, because if you came in 10 years ago and said, go with this, you know, virtualized open approach, they wouldn't have had the sub infrastructure to do that. You know, you talked about them earlier in the podcast as being, you know, being WYSI and innovative. Really, it took them about a decade to use DevOps technology and techniques, I should say, to really overhaul their infrastructure to the point where they can actually take advantage of something like ORAN. They're here now. So this is actually perfect timing. So they're going to be able to be both a whole lot more competitive. They're going to start seeing their margins grow again, which is something that they desperately need, because otherwise, you know, they're going to choke themselves, and they're going to be a lot more agile. So I think all the pieces are coming together for telcos to really roar ahead in the coming years. And what I'm keeping a close eye on.
Do you really think that they deserve more margin? Like, I think that they should be treated like electricity companies, and you don't actually have a right to make 60-80% gross margin. You have a right to make a 10-15% gross margin and 5% net. There's no reason for mobile phone companies to earn a premium, is there?
Well, as I said earlier, I was really happy to see, you know, back in the old days, I was really happy to see them forced to stick to a limited profit and plow their excess revenue back into Bell Labs. And I think that model works really well. But this is, you know, 2020, 2021. And the real problem with telcos today is their margins have decreased to the point where they're, you know, it's not viable operationally using old technology. So they were forced to.
They never wanted 5G.
Well, it's not 5G. I'm looking at the whole infrastructure that telcos had, because they had proprietary, they were the last, you know, last in networking to have proprietary hardware, proprietary software, and as you said, you know, switches in a box, solutions in a box. And as price competition started to rise, their margins went down and down and down. And so they were sort of choking up until about 10 years ago when they put a full-on investment in DevOps. And that's why I think they need to go up a bit more when they can start to reach the points that you're talking about again. And then, sure, I'd like to carve some of that off and give it back to the common good.
Yeah.
But let's get there first.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about Open RAN is it actually opens up what happens inside.
Correct.
So you can now actually start to say, I can replace this routing solution with that, you know, this virtual router with that virtual router, because the APIs are the same and it'll snap into my manager. Or I can replace the billing system because the APIs, it's a bit like Kubernetes in the enterprise space. Kubernetes is going to become the default API for orchestrating VMs and containers.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, well, I think the other advantage to Open RAN is that it allows easy embedding into, you know, robotic process automation, so that you can literally, you don't have to change your processes as you change your solutions. So you have that easy plug and play, but you can also automate a lot of things, which means you're really reducing the costs of doing things, you're reducing the likelihood of mistakes, and increasing the agility for that. And those are three things that carriers desperately need, and they're getting.
And they also need to be able to use white box if they want, or branded if they want, right?
Exactly, and they're moving to that, yeah.
Some of them will, and some of them won't, and some of them are trialing white box, and some of them are trialing commercials. It'll be very interesting to see how that pans out over the years to come. So anyway, more on Open RAN, looking good, Vodafone, so we'll keep tracking that as we go forward. I want to switch now to remote proctoring. Now, many of you have been talking to us about remote proctoring as people are passing their certifications, and we've seen a lot of people say that remote proctoring of examinations has become a way to keep doing your certifications even though we're in the pandemic era. And in-person testing, however, obviously is limited these days, if not completely off the board. But there are a lot of questions being asked about the companies that are operating these remote proctoring. I heard people say that proctors just failed to turn up, or they kept intruding on them while they were doing the exam and saying, please, you know, show my camera around the room. This article here from TechCrunch was actually talking about the company. Somebody did some research, security researcher looked into the company Proctorio and did some analysis of the Chrome plugin and realized that the Chrome plugin is A, highly insecure, B, it's taking all the data all the time, not just for the duration of your exam time frame. And so he just published a series of tweets and said, you know, this is some data, this doesn't look quite right. And then Proctorio reacted with a DMC takedown to Twitter and to a whole bunch of sites, Pastebin and even the Internet Archive, demanding that his comments be taken down because he's breached the license of the Chrome plugin. It's extraordinary.
Well, I wouldn't worry too much about it, Greg, because I have it on good authority that Proctorio is going to be installing this in the voting machines for the U.S. election starting in 2024. So everything's going to be great. They'll be monitoring your eye motions and monitoring your facial expressions and deciding ahead of time whether that's a false vote that you're casting. So it's all good.
It's hysterical, right? The idea that looking at your eye motion or the way that your facial expressions is actually a measure of whether you're cheating or not. We've seen time after time these sorts of made-up promises that from somebody in Silicon Valley who believes that, you know, they can use off-the-shelf tools to do something. And they just go and say stuff with zero proof. And this really is an extraordinary response. I think there's something here. I think that this remote proctoring is not what it's supposed to be. This idea that you can automate that is false.
Well, and I think one of the things in the article that really leapt out at me is something that's an ongoing problem, which is that, you know, you can't necessarily detect skin tones for people with darker skin tones, which, yeah, believe it or not, was one of the first problems with AI in restroom hand washers. So apparently, Black people discovered en masse that, weirdly enough, the water will not start when you put your hands underneath the automatic faucets because apparently the AI is not going to detect darker skin tones. So yeah. I was actually happy to see that because that's a social issue that people are now very conscious of. And, you know, even though it's not the most heinous thing here, it's actually something that's going to grab people's attention and go, hang on, this really needs to be looked at. So I was delighted to see that.
So just remember, you are not the customer of Proctorio. It's your IT vendor who's consuming that service. So, and you can safely assume that your IT vendor who's using these remote proctoring services is going to do nothing because certification is a pain in the butt to them and they don't want to do anything about these things. So make sure that you complain long and hard about this remote proctoring if it's not coming up to spec, because that is the only way that that solution is going to change, I think. And you would be right to do so. I don't believe that remote proctoring in its current form is reaching optimal state. Let's take another break to thank our sponsor, Ping Plotter. Now, Cloud Connect from our sponsor, Ping Plotter, expands a classic tool. I've been using Ping Plotter, I think, 25 years ago. I started with it when I was doing networks way back in the old day. And it supports remote workforce troubleshooting. It collects foundational performance metrics from internal and external connections. It lets you deploy an agent to any Windows or macOS device within minutes. And then you only pay for active use. You toggle which connections you monitor on the fly and you modify your plan as you need. No 3-year contracts to get stuck in. It's a very simple tool. It's got very basic functionality. So if you want that, it's got many monitoring and management tools that have extra features that you always need. But Cloud Connect just simplifies it down to the essential network performance metrics so that small teams can get help and large teams can augment their existing stack without needing to learn or relearn or get stuck in a whole ecosystem of visibility tooling. Ping Plotter gives you up-to-second snapshots, or you can find broader patterns as you see fit. It's got live updates, read-only views of customer network performance so you can share them with people, and you can keep anxious customers serene by showing them that you're actively troubleshooting and get mean time to innocence, showing it's not your fault. Learn more about Ping Plotter Cloud Connect and how it can help you better utilize your support teams. Schedule a free 15-minute overview at pingplotter.com/packetpushers. It's kind of a cool tool. Something that's been around for so long is still here, and they've come up with a cloud-enabled version. A simple tool that really you can get using with pretty quickly. Thanks very much to Ping Plotter for sponsoring Network Break. All right, let's keep pushing on. It's been a busy couple of weeks for financial reporting. The general trend has been for technology companies to be up. Just about across the board, revenues are up, costs are down, and profits are sweet there, or buku, as they say in some places. Let's start with F5 Networks, Jonah. F5 announced that their revenue was up 4%, but net income was down at $614 million in revenue for Q4. Reminder just how small F5 Networks is compared to other technology companies.
Yep. Well, I think as you pointed out, you know, they're highlighting the fact that it's their software revenues versus hardware. And I want to just point to the fact that they are actually doing a great job converting their customers to software customers, buying subscriptions, which is exactly the direction they need to be going in. So, yeah, they're small, but they're doing it right.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Like F5 seems to loom large in many people's minds, but it's actually just a tiny minnow of a technology company. Must try and remember that going forward. One of the things that boggled me is that F5 is now paying 10% of its revenue in share-based compensation. That's boggling.
I just see that as you know, kind of another way that they're doing things right from a financial perspective. Mm. Yes, they're small, but they're growing. Mm. And they're going in the right strategic direction, which is more than a lot of big companies are able to pull off.
Yeah, like 60 million of share-based compensation out of 600 million in revenue. That seems pretty juicy for the I guess if it goes down, the employees or the people who are getting the share bonuses are going to be unhappy, I suppose.
Well, and you talked about capitalism working as it's supposed to. You know, we forget that actually the share payouts is really what capitalism is about. It's not the appreciation of, you know, the stock market. You really want to do the payouts and the dividends, and that's what really motivates capitalism. And I'm happy to see someone that's staying true to the, you know, fundamental principles here.
Arista Networks did better in its expected results. It's up share price is up 4.1% after hours after its Q3 earnings, where it beat both on top and bottom lines. It continues to gain in the service aspects, even though people were expecting a revenue drop. Overall revenue was expected to drop by double digits, but declined just 7.5% to $600 million. And net income fell to $192 million from $217 million. My guess is, Joan and I, that it's costing a lot more to sell gear to enterprises than it did to cloud companies from a couple of years ago.
Yes. I just figured every now and then people like to hear silence.
Yeah, I think so there you go. She agrees with me. Well, that's the only one we've had so far. Finally, I want to talk about Gartner. Gartner is recovering from the financial damage caused by the demise of its physical events business. I've been smiling to myself that CIOs around the world are whining and complaining about the lack of conferences they may attend to get away from their staff for a few days. So Gartner's reported a 12% lift in share price after they'd said Q3 revenue was driven up to nearly $995 million by a combination of virtual conferences, virtual meetings, and a range of technology sales. In the dialogue, as they were speaking to analysts, they said the average contact for enterprises continues to grow. It now stands at $227,000 for each customer. I am totally in the wrong business, right? Each enterprise, $230,000.
You absolutely are, and those numbers don't shock me at all because that's the business I'm in.
Yeah.
I will highlight the fact that what's happened over the past 20 years is people have shrunk IT departments to the point where it's, you know, a bare-bones staff, and now they're getting all their advice and strategic planning from vendors, and they realize that's not an effective way to do things. So, you know, you can argue whether it's too much to pay, but I think the need for third-party advice has never been stronger.
Yeah, and it is. Do you think enterprises should be restocking their talent pool, like their competency pool, to get back, or should they still be outsourcing it to research companies? Do you think, or is there a balance to be struck here?
Well, let's highlight something. Research is down, consulting is up. I do think consulting makes more sense. Of course, I'm biased, and let me be clear about this. I should have mentioned this. We do compete with Gartner, and we offer the same set of services, research and consulting. But the big advantage of consulting is you can bring somebody in to solve a problem, and then when you've solved the problem, you don't have to keep them on the payroll or keep the advisory service. And
I think you also lose the skill. So when the consultant walks out the door, the skills and the lessons that they learned walk out the door with them.
Well, keep in mind, though, this is advisory stuff, so it's not necessarily hands-on, I'm going to come configure your router. And there's also
the advisory stuff is still a skill. So strategic, understanding the market, understanding the positioning, understanding what your internal organization is just as valuable a skill as it is configuring a load balancer.
Right, but in all honesty, when I go in and work with an enterprise, I actually teach them how to do that. So, you know, companies that I've been working with for 10, 12, 15 years, they come to me with each year at a higher level of sophistication saying, okay, now I know how to do this particular strategy, but I need help over here. So right. I think you almost want to think of it more as a coaching exercise, and the coach is always available, but not on the payroll so that you have to, you know, there's sunk cost.
Yeah, I tend to see consulting as an expert, and you actually want to have that expert on staff. You want to have in-house strategic advice on your team to keep your team on track, because so many times the coach comes in, you know, it comes in for 2 weeks at the beginning of the year, and then you're expected to go out and run on the pitch for the next 13 weeks, to use a sports metaphor, and there's no coach to keep you holding to the vision.
Well, you can keep the coach on tap for as long as you wish. I mean, I really do disagree rather strongly with this because I spend a lot of time teaching my clients, making sure they're up to speed in what they need to do. And they know what I do and they know what they do and they know when to reach out and tap me and when they've got it. And I just sort of send them an attaboy and let them go do it.
All right, let's get to our last story of the day, unspendable Bitcoin. It turns out that back about 5 to 10 years ago when Silk Road, you might remember them as a dark website where all sorts of nasty things was happening and illegal things, they had about $1 billion worth of Bitcoin trapped, or wasn't that much back then, but it was a lot of Bitcoin was actually locked up when the US government went in and seized that website. And then this week, there was an event where $1 billion of Bitcoin was suddenly moved because the Bitcoin blockchain is no longer private. It's not a secret anymore. There's enough computation power that you can watch the entire ledger of the blockchain. So the days of Bitcoin allowing you to move money without being monitored is over. And so there was a big hoo-ha when somebody noticed that the blockchain associated, that bit of the blockchain associated with Silk Road suddenly moved. And everybody thought, oh, somebody's liberating $1 billion worth of Bitcoins. Turns out it was the US Justice Department, which I thought was hysterical.
Well, I don't see much of a surprise there. This I predicted from the very beginning, because governments do not want currencies that are not linked to governments and that they don't have some control over. I would also point out that if you're really counting on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, watch out for quantum cryptography, which is just over the horizon, which is going to blow up all of these because they're all predicated on the inability of current cryptographic algorithms to crack things. That's going to change when quantum cryptography arrives.
Yeah, the never-ending comedy of blockchain is just, it's endlessly entertaining. The solution that continues to look for a problem that everybody feels is one day, we're going to find something that it's good for. And the belief in Silicon Valley is so strong that they still are spending billions of dollars in making it happen. But the flip side of this is, imagine having $1 billion in Bitcoin that you aren't able to cash in because the cops are watching it. Imagine if you had access to that for the last 5 years or whatever it is, and you'd be going like, if only I could do, but as soon as you do, you know the feds are going to be on top of your tail. Well, Jonah, where can people find out more about you? Thank you so much for joining today. I really appreciate you. It's been a fairly good, robust discussion. So where can people find more?
Well, start at nemertes.com. That begins with an nemertes.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Best place to reach me on LinkedIn or on email, jonah@nemertes.com.
Stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Fortinet. We're talking with Smile Dental about their rollout of SDN with the Fortinet SD brand solution. It's not actually the thing that you expect. It's actually quite an interesting story in there, and it's coming from the customer himself who actually rolled it out and then changed his SD-WAN vendor strategy in midstream. That's coming right up. This is a Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers. On today's show, sponsored by Fortinet, we're discussing an SD-WAN deployment with Smile Brands, a network of dental practices in the USA. Now, Smile Brands has an interesting story where they started with one SD-WAN solution, discovered how great it was, but then switched to an integrated security SD-WAN and SD-Brand solution from Fortinet. The first SD-WAN solution highlighted that SD-WAN was workable for them, but a better solution was something that did more than just SD-WAN. Joining us today is Brett Stetsko. He's a senior network engineer for Smile Brands to talk about his experience with the Fortinet Secure SD-WAN and Branch. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Brett. Let's get straight into things. Tell me how you got started on the path to SD-WAN.
Well, hi, Greg, and I appreciate the opportunity. We started the path to SD-WAN essentially because we wanted to save money, wanted faster speeds for our offices. We traditionally had T1 MPLS circuits, and obviously with this day and age, applications need much more bandwidth than 1.5 megs. So that's where SD-WAN kind of came into play, along with, you know, enhancing the security at the offices, potentially looking at direct internet access.
Yeah, you would have been under a lot of pressure. This is a fairly traditional story. You've got the two T1s, they're expensive, and the bandwidth is limited. And you thought, well, if I could use internet and do SD-WAN, then I could probably 10x the bandwidth for half the money.
That's correct.
That's a pretty traditional story. Did your first attempt at SD-WAN work okay?
It worked pretty good. It accomplished the speeds. It accomplished the redundancy we wanted at the offices, whether that be LTE or a secondary circuit. It just didn't provide, our original solution didn't provide any additional security, any type of direct internet access, because we couldn't at the time send them out directly without that security. So we were still backhauling, but it did increase the speeds.
So really,
that redundancy.
So even though you could have given direct internet access, there's a security challenge there. Like, Were you offering it to the to patients or to guests to be able to go to the internet, or was it just for staff?
Just for staff.
But you still needed to log it and inspect it? Like, you can't just let them do everything, really.
That's correct.
That made you sort of migrate away from the Silver Peak and start to look at Fortinet. What led you down the path to Fortinet? How did you get there from Silver Peak to Fortinet?
Well, we were looking at solutions that would provide all the things that we were still short on, security and potentially looking at also managing an easier way to manage, especially for our help desk, the LAN side of things. Fortinet offered both. You got the next-gen firewall security directly on the box, and we got the SD-WAN, and we also had SD-Branch, which is a huge added bonus as well. So that way there's a single pane of glass, not just to manage, but to monitor the offices. And that and security, we were able to allow direct internet access, point also allow guest access because we had the security that we needed and the ability to really segregate the networks.
So you've sort of gone from the replacing routers, because you would have had a routed network. You would have had some sort of probably Cisco routers, I guess, connected to the T1s.
That's correct.
And then there was a whole branch networking piece after that to connect all the computers to the routers. A fairly traditional
That's
model.
Correct.
And then all of a sudden you realize, well, if we add security, there's a whole bunch of other things. What you're thinking, why am I not just doing all this in one box? Why do I have a router and a switch and a wireless and a firewall? Why not just put it all in one?
Yeah, and making it more complicated to troubleshoot. You have more to manage financially because you have obviously support on multiple different vendors, multiple different contacts if there's an issue. So we wanted to try to shore that all up in the one solution if it was available, and that's where Fortinet came in.
So this SD-Branch stuff, if you've got everything in one box, you said before that it made it easier to administrate it. Are you talking about a single console to manage all of it then?
That's correct. That was one of the big selling points. Fortinet obviously doesn't have an overpriced solution. They have a very cost-effective solution. And then adding on top of that, the fact that you can manage the switch, wireless, the cellular backup, and the SD-WAN, next-gen firewall, all in one box, monitor it all in one box, centralized logging, that was a huge advantage. Allowing not just the network staff, but even other staff, read-only access to be able to see these things for troubleshooting. Not everybody's effective on the CLI. I'm a network engineer, so I love the CLI, but not everybody does. So staff that don't access the CLI, the GUI management with Fortinet, and all of those solutions together through one pane of glass was huge, honestly.
That's important because you don't want to have to do everything. It's easier for you if you can delegate some of the configuration work or some of the administration
Precisely.
Work to other people. Oh, congratulations on doing less work then, I suppose.
Still doing as much work, but now it's improvements, not just troubleshooting
as much. Oh, so. Yes, of course. Of course.
In IT, we're always doing something, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, most people tell me when they have a single management console is all of a sudden your security posture changes too, because if you use the CLI everywhere, you tend to end up with this firewall's a little bit different to this firewall. Where if you've got centralized control, you're probably a bit better off.
That's correct. And the fact that Fortinet allows full CLI access, and a very good CLI at that, allows us to script changes we want to make. But since we utilize FortiManager to send out the scripts, so we're still centralizing the management. Even if there's something we need to script, it's still a single pane of glass with our central management and FortiManager.
So that's pretty interesting. And that's got all your configuration backups and all the status stuff. And it's probably giving you some visibility as well. So all of a sudden,
absolutely.
And now you're doing dentistry and you're managing remote dentist locations. It's not necessarily that you've got big offices. It's really you've got a lot of them because you've got a couple of hundred.
Yeah, we got over 400.
Just keeping all that, all those juggling and working is actually a substantial overhead.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And the traditional route, we had some makeshift solutions to send configurations out, but centralizing with our legacy solution was much more complicated. And logging and everything, it was all different solutions, different vendors.
It's hard to underestimate that. It's hard to overstate how simply that is now, because a lot of the dentist's offices tend to be fairly small, don't they? Like 10, 20 people at most.
That's correct. Yeah, they vary in sizes. We have the small dental offices across the country, but there's a lot of them, and they do have unique needs. Most of them are standardized, so it makes it much easier, especially when it comes to security.
when we were discussing preparing for the show, you said too that you have a lot of changes. You have dental practices joining and leaving the business at any point in time. So you actually have a secondary challenge here where the network's not just a set and forget. It's actually constantly evolving.
Not so much removing offices, but we are definitely adding offices. Whether there's a new build, whether it's another dental practice joining our existing network, regardless, yes, it makes it easy too, because when the configuration is standardized and centralized, especially at Fortinet, we have kind of like a one-stop solution. We have a branch in a box pretty much that we deploy out there. There's not a whole lot of variation with the offices. There is some, but it's pretty much standardized across the board. Using the Fortinet manager and having the SD branch GUI on the FortiGates, that makes it a lot easier.
And it's only a couple of boxes of gear. Is it multiple boxes? Just one box for each site?
So we have a FortiGate, FortiSwitch, FortiAP, and FortiExtender.
All unified in a single management console. So you don't actually kind of care that they're different boxes.
Exactly.
Let's move on to talking about what were the outcomes to the business. So obviously moving from T1s to internet, did it get faster?
That's an understatement. It increased the speeds, absolutely. Obviously, ISPs are different in different areas. Speed availabilities are different. But at a minimum, I'd say it probably increased each office at least tenfold. That's at the very minimum. That opened up the door for us to add other applications. We simply could not support new applications, whether it be internal or SaaS. The majority of the applications just were not supportable on the legacy solution. So that opened up the door for us to not just simplify the network side, but the application side as well. So that way the office staff could start using things that would help them out.
Some people don't think of things, 1.5 megs is slow, but it actually is. When you share it between 10 or 20 people,
yes,
and they're all doing things at the same time, it's actually very limiting. As soon as you get to about 10 megs for those remote branches, things just take off. Things change. Things work that didn't work. Print jobs that couldn't be printed suddenly print without causing people to pause for 10 minutes while the print job ran or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the simplest things in the world. And then I'm guessing too, because T1s sound expensive, budget reductions?
Huge budget reductions. We were able to save a very significant amount on the circuits and on the equipment.
Okay.
So having one vendor, obviously, everybody knows in an IT world, if you go with a vendor, they're obviously going to reduce the cost. Fortinet was an exception to that.
Right.
So having all the equipment through one vendor helps financially with the equipment. It also helped probably the most with the circuits.
What sort of savings do you think? 50, 60, 80?
Depends on the office, but on average, I'd say we're probably saving between 60 and 70% total.
And one of the questions that people ask me about SD-WAN is how do you track all the circuits? Like some people say, well, I don't want to be managing two internet connections per site. How are you handling that?
There's a few vendors out there. I'm not going to name them, but the one we use, they actually manage all the circuits for us as far as troubleshooting the circuits themselves, not our equipment, but the circuits and the billing. So that way we go through a single vendor that deploys, manages, pays everything.
Because you've got like 600 internet connections now that you've got to reconcile and keep track of.
Yeah, give or take. Honestly, I don't know the number, but that's not far off if it is.
Yeah, so, yeah, you know, whatever the number might
be. Hundreds of connections would be a headache internally. So we use a vendor that actually bills us, and we don't have to worry about every circuit.
The operational side, we touched on that a minute ago. You've got to be having that one solution simplifies the whole day-to-day process.
Yes. I'll be honest, it actually isn't any less difficult than it was with traditional legacy MPLS. There's a lot of the big vendors out there, they're not exactly responsive, as many of us know. So really not losing anything if you're going with a single vendor, multiple ISPs.
Yeah, you're not really a customer of a telco. You're more of a victim.
That way to put it.
Once you've bought something, you're just one of a million customers, and you don't really matter. It's like saying, you know, Coca-Cola cares about you as a person. No, they don't. Not at all.
Yeah, your service response doesn't really change regardless of how many offices you have. So you're not losing anything at all.
I could imagine your whole day-to-day life is a lot simpler. You've just got less futz work, like scut work, doing this isn't working and you've got to look at it and it's a cable, or, you know, this switch isn't working with it. Is that right?
Yes. One of the biggest things is because of the single pane of glass, because of the monitoring that we have built into a single solution using Fortinet, we have more information when it gets to us. It'll start with our help desk and it'll get escalated to us. They already have more information available. So we're not starting from scratch when we get most of the tickets. We actually already have a good amount of information and it's a lot quicker for us to get it.
Yeah.
So even if they don't have the information, let's say it's a new help desk person or they just can't figure out at all, it's still easier for us to obtain the information now because of both FortiManager and we're using FortiAnalyzer for the logging. We need to look at logs. We need to look at, is the office up? I mean, there's DDNS that we're using at the SD-WAN offices. We have names associated with every circuit. It makes it a lot easier for us to access it. Traditional MPLS, if it's down, there's no way to get to the office. So now that we have LTE as a backup,
primary circuit,
we can still get to the office unless there's a power issue. 95% of the time, we can access the equipment if there's an issue.
You're just better off everywhere around with SD-WAN because it's internet, it's faster. It's faster not just from bandwidth. It's also less latent. What we're finding is a lot of the telco networks are just slower than the internet connections.
Yeah, there's no difference in that, really. If anything, there's an improvement, like you're saying. It hasn't slowed down. So that's really – that was one of the concerns we had too, and it hasn't really slowed down as far as latency. So we haven't seen an increase in latency to the offices generally.
And you've got the firewall as well, so you know where the security is, and so you're
– The one thing about it is I can sleep a little easier. So it's not as many offices, and you know, traditionally, if there is an office outage with an MPLS solution, you're kind of – blind troubleshooting, work with the staff or get a tech on site, but you can't see anything. So again, you know, if you have backup circuits, which we do, you still have access to the equipment.
The office is still running. Might not be working perfectly, but at least it's still doing something while you're getting the problem.
It's better to run less perfectly, but still run than not at all.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time for today's Tech Bytes, and I've really enjoyed talking with Brett about his SD-WAN solution. And he's got an unusual story here, how he started on the SD-WAN journey and he ended up in the SD-WAN and security. If you want more information around the Fortinet product, go over to fortinet.com/product/SD-WAN. There's a whole bunch of information on there. They've got lots of detail about the SD-WAN products. It sounds like from talking to Brett today that having a look at the FortiManager, everything at Fortinet's got a 40-something in front of it. Everything's a 40 thing. But you'll just have to get over that and keep moving through it until you find the FortiManager. Maybe take a quick look at that. As always, it's been great to have you with us on the Tech Bytes, and you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our website at packetpushers.net. If you'd like more like this, contact us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on the LinkedIn, and like us on the Apple Podcasts. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.